Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
I got a fever and the only prescription is more Patrick Madrid. Come on.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Cyrus, you heard about that truck crash from a lab, and the truck was carrying 100 macaque monkeys, and some of them got away. You heard about that?
The lab monkeys that escaped?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen way too many movies where that's how the movie starts.
You know, I had the same thought, too. It happened in Pennsylvania. Well, one woman who was there when this pickup truck that tipped over, and, you know, it was stacked with these cages of monkeys. And the monkeys were involved in lab experiments. It's not clear what kind of experiments were being done on them. According to the articles, when the authorities arrived, they killed the monkeys that were there, and then I guess they caught some of the monkeys. It looks like there's still one out and about. I don't know what the latest is on that one, but there was one that they have not accounted for, at least as of, I guess, last night. But this lady, her name is Michelle Fallon. She was there. She saw the truck tip over. It actually had a collision with a dump truck, and all the monkeys, you know, in the cages and then a few that were out there. So she told a local news station that she thought she was just doing the right thing by helping. She started looking at the dozens of crates that tumbled out of the truck, and she encountered one of the agitated monkeys. Now, this is a New York Post article this morning. She recalled another motorist saying that she thought she saw a cat run across the road. Just as she peeked into one of the crates, she saw a monkey staring back at her. Fallon later became alarmed when officials warned the public not to go near or approach the four monkeys that escaped, if they should find them, because they could transmit diseases. These monkeys and their diseases. I couldn't help it. I could not. I flashed on that song immediately the first time I read this. They got problems enough as it is. Leave these poor monkeys alone. They got problems enough as it is. She contacted the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which told her to take immediate precautions. Could you imagine? You're a good Samaritan. You're trying to help the agitated monkeys. You call the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and they say, take immediate precautions. Like, I guess they told her, get to a hospital right away. She says, I was close to the monkeys. I touched the crates. I walked through their feces. So I was very close. So I called to inquire, you know, was I safe? So she went to the hospital, and as luck would have it, she happened to have an open cut on her hand, and she started developing pink eye symptoms. She feared it might be linked to the monkeys. So they gave her a rabies vaccine dose, and she has to take antiviral medication for 2 weeks. She said, the monkey hissed at me and with all the feces and the open cut. I think for me, the open cut is the worst part about it.
Oh, man.
Then, I mean, I'm not laughing because the poor thing, I feel bad for her. I really do. And I hope that nothing comes of it. And I sure hope that rabies is the worst of whatever it was they were experimenting on these monkeys. I sure hope it wasn't something worse, because like you said, this is how some of these terrible disaster movies start. You know, you're just bebopping along with your open cut. Next thing you know, you're standing in monkey feces. And you're going to the hospital.
Yeah, there. Contagion is one where I think that one starts off with monkeys getting from a lab, escaping.
Escaping.
Escaping. All right, you're on your own.
Yeah. All right. Well, that story is still in the news. I wanted you to know about it. So if you see a monkey on your way home this afternoon, I don't think they can travel that far from Pennsylvania unless he hitchhiked. Anything's possible, but I would not pick the monkey up. It would shock the monkey if you picked him up because he's not expecting it. 888-914-9149. Sandy in Rockford, Illinois. Thank you for waiting and welcome.
Oh, thanks, Patrick. I'm calling because, well, I have a feeling that you were very good and still are a very good parent. And I have two boys that are going to be taking Drive Right here in April. And okay. Someone recently told me that you had them pay the fees completely for Drive Right. And I want to know if that's true. And then also if you had them pay for insurance. And then on a side note, I just wanted to say this real quick. An Illinois bill was just passed yesterday that all public schools have to have feminine products and tampons and pads in the boys' and girls' bathrooms. So,
is that for menstruating people, people who menstruate?
It's for people who menstruate, yes, but that's what, and now it's a law effective immediately in the boys' and girls' bathrooms.
Yeah.
They have to have those available, which is disgusting, yeah. I think.
You know, it used to be, I don't know how old you are, Sandy, but it used to be, like when I was growing up, that adults ran the school boards and schools. It would be like adults who were the principals and the counselors. Now, you know, it's run by children. Run by maybe people with adult bodies, but children's intellects, because they do silly
Correct.
Things like this. Well, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah.
But I'm sure the menstruating people out there are just cheering because they'll have these products available to them. It's ridiculous, isn't it?
It is. And we're paying for it too. So,
How much you want to bet that there will be vandalism in the boys' room? Not just smoking in the boys' room, but vandalism in the boys' room. Could you imagine how long those machines on the wall are going to last in the typical boys' room in a high school? I don't think they're going to last very long.
I hope they don't. Not that I encourage vandalism, but they don't belong there.
Yeah, I would never encourage vandalism, nor would I ever encourage graffiti, for that matter.
Yeah.
But people are people.
Yeah.
So you want to talk about car insurance and teenagers?
Yeah. So did you have your kids pay the full price for Drive Right? And then did you have them pay their own insurance, like just have some skin in the game? I'm just wondering how you did it.
Yeah.
This is all new territory for us.
Absolutely. I'd be happy to reprise some comments that I made on that topic maybe yesterday or the day before. I forget. But So... the long and the short of it, Sandy, is that when our kids, all of whom are grown up now, so Nancy and I have 11 children, 6 boys, 5 girls, all adults, now we're 28 grandchildren deep into it. So this is in the rearview mirror for me. But when they were adults and when they were teenagers, rather, and as they approached 16, the policy was, and we did this for all of them, was that number one, if you want to get your driver's permit, you can, and we're happy to facilitate that for you. But in order to get the driver's permit, you have to take, I guess it's Drive Right up there. You know, different schools have different names, but the driving school that you have to take if you are under 18, required by law. And we're happy to let you take that course. We'll drive you to the course, but you have to pay for the course. So back in those days, I don't know what prices are like now, but back in those days, it seems like it was about $250 to take the driving course, which spanned, I don't know, 10 weeks or 8 weeks, something like that. So we said, you can go, but you have to pay for it. And what that meant was they had to get a part-time job in order to raise the money to pay for the driving school. And each of them did it. Not all of them were happy about it, but all of them had to do it. So they paid for their driving school. And then once they had their learner's permit, I would facilitate by helping them learn how to drive. Nancy did that too, to some extent. But between the two of us, we would give them more driving lessons, go to the park, you know, and in the big old parking lot, you know, practice doing maneuvers and things. So by the time they got their driver's licenses and they were street legal at that point, then it was, okay, well, you have to have car insurance. So until you're 18, you can be on our policy, but we would find out from the, you know, from Allstate, how much does this son of mine who's 17 years old, how much of my monthly bill is because of him? And they would give us the figure, and then he would have to pay that. So each month, if it was $100, whatever. I don't even remember now what it was, but that was another thing that he had to pay for each month. And then when they turned 18, every single one of them, they had to spin off from our policy and get their own policy, which they paid for on their own. And that's how we did it for all of them. And then just as an aside, we did the same thing with cell phones. So when you're, you know, 16, 17 years old and you've shown that you're mature enough to get a cell phone, we'll get you a cell phone, but you have to pay for it. And so for the year or two that you're on our family plan, whatever the amount of your phone is and the service that, that you're, you know, that it costs us for you, for your line, you have to pay for that. And then when they hit 18, the same thing as with the car insurance, we made them spin off and they were not allowed to be on our plan anymore. And they had to get their own plan and they had to pay for their own plan. So that's how we handled it.
Okay, that sounds good. I like it. I love it, actually. It's I don't feel like such a mean mom hearing you did it. So,
well, I mean, I'm not the perfect dad, that's for sure. But I tried to in this area do some. Well, I shouldn't say I. Nancy and I both agreed on this, but we tried to do this because, or we did this, I should say, because we wanted them to become self-sufficient, and we had seen kind of horror stories from some of our other friends and peers who were just monthly paying all these bills for their kids who were in college and even in some cases out of college. They'd pay for their car insurance. They'd pay the car payment. They'd pay the cell phone bill. And we thought that's insanity because you're just letting this umbilical cord stretch indefinitely and it's got to be cut. They have to learn not only how to be self-sufficient and get out there and hustle and make money, but they also have to learn the value of things. And when it's dad's money that's being spent, yeah, you don't really put much of a value on it because you don't have to sacrifice anything for it. If dad is spending all the money, it doesn't really matter that much. But if you're the one spending the money, then suddenly right. It becomes a lot more valuable. And that's the lesson we wanted them to learn. That was our goal.
Okay. And hopefully they'll drive a little more careful because of it.
Yeah.
That's my hope. So, yeah, okay. I mean, well, thank you, Patrick. Yeah.
You're welcome. You're most welcome, Sandy. And I'm sure you and your husband are doing a great job. You know, I remember a few times when, you know, after all of our admonitions about driving safe and give plenty of room to stop and don't tailgate and don't speed and, you know, one of our sons, typically it was sons, I don't remember any of our daughters doing this, but, you know, get an offender bender or get a speeding ticket, and they watched as their insurance rates went through the roof. And dad wasn't going to pay that. You know, gee, sorry. You know, life's tough in the big city. Too bad. But that's on you. So when the 19 or 20-year-old kid saw his insurance rates go sky high, that painful lesson, I think, you know, more often than not, it taught them such a lesson that they learned how to be more careful when they were driving. So these are difficult lessons to learn when you're young, but I think they're important. And honestly, I really do believe, and I don't say this to be in any way judgmental about anybody, but just seeing how it worked, and not just with one kid, but with 11 kids. So there's a pretty big study population, a lot of different personalities, boys and girls. I found that it really does work. And I realize that it may be in the eyes of some people, oh, that's too harsh, or that's too, why are you so rigorous? Or, you know, that's, you know, you can't you be nicer about it? Well, yeah, but I think the payoff to me seems so huge in terms of the kids learning these lessons. And then I guess for me, it's also been gratifying to see how some of them are using the same principle with their kids now that their kids are teenagers and they're beginning to apply some of the same principles. So I feel vindicated. I'm not the perfect dad, never have been, but I think I scored on that one. Thank you. 888-914-9149. How about Paul now in Northern California? Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Patrick. Thank you. A quick question about conditional baptism.
Okay.
Could it be administered at any time, or should it be administered at the Easter Vigil?
So let's say baptism as such, and as a subset of that, conditional baptism, if there's a question about the validity of what is presumed to be a baptism, that can be administered at any time, especially in cases of emergency. But in terms of a formal welcoming of the person into the church, if that's the scenario, then that's traditionally done at the Easter Vigil, where the church formally welcomes these people into the church, whether non-baptized or baptized. So the church might say, yes, you can be conditionally baptized, but we're going to do that on the day that you're received into the church. Or in the case of a conditional baptism, it might be done beforehand, because then you would want to go to confession. So let me give you a scenario, Paul. So let's say that you are not sure, and there's no way to know for sure if you actually had been baptized. You think you might have been, but there's no evidence demonstrating that you were baptized. So if you're conditionally baptized, before you would receive the Holy Eucharist, you would also need to go to confession, which you could now do, because either you were baptized before, or you were just conditionally baptized. But since there's no way to know one way or the other, the custom would be you would go to confession and then receive the Holy Eucharist. Now, if the time elapse was very short, I thought I was baptized last summer, I don't know if it was valid, there may be some change in that. But that baptism could be given at any time based on necessity, if there were an emergency, let's say.
Okay. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, because I'm continuing my inquiry.
Wonderful. Are you scheduled yet? Are you one of the elect yet in terms of coming into the church at Easter time?
No, I've been a Catholic since second grade.
Ah.
And I'm just learning about, there's no baptismal record that I can track down.
Okay.
So if I were to get married, if I were to receive the other sacraments, there's no record of my baptism. So I'm contemplating conditional baptism.
That could be done at any time. If you don't mind me asking a couple questions, do you happen to know what parish you were attending with your parents when you were that age?
I actually was for my baptism.
Yeah, the reason I ask is that parishes are meticulous in documenting baptisms and keeping records. So if you knew what parish your parents were at when you were, I think you said second grade, and you were Catholic at that time, if you had been baptized at that parish, they would have a record of it in the office.
Oh, well, the thing is, I know I was baptized Methodist.
Okay.
But a priest has recently told me that the form and the matter were lacking.
Oh. How were you baptized? Do you remember that, or did your parents tell you?
Actually, I do. I just found out very recently.
Okay.
The Methodist minister made the sign of the cross on my forehead with water.
Oh.
Baptizing with the Tridentine formula, Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. But then very recently a priest told me that, well, the water should be flowing.
Right.
So
that's
these are
true.
Details that, okay.
Yeah. That would fall into the category of doubtful. And when there's
Okay.
Yeah, so when there's doubt, so you can have a situation where you know that you are certain that the form and the matter are valid. You can be certain that the form and or the matter are invalid, or it can be doubtful whether the form or the matter, or both, were valid. So in the case of certain that it wasn't valid or doubtfully valid, in that case, conditional baptism would be the right thing to do. So your parish priest, to put it this way, your parish priest, if you were to say, you know, I've been living as a Catholic or whatever the story is, and if there's no compelling need for you to wait until the Easter Vigil, and if the priest felt that you were ready to embark upon the sacramental life, maybe give you some instructions privately if he wanted to do that, he could do that, and then you could be baptized conditionally, and then you're off to the races.
Well, that's really interesting. I greatly appreciate all the info, Patrick.
You're most welcome, Paul. It's exciting, isn't
day.
It?
Thank you.
If I may ask you, are you excited about the idea of beginning to receive the Eucharist, etc.?
Well, I'm sorry for failing to mention, I've been Catholic all my life.
Uh-huh.
Did I make that clear?
You mentioned that you were Catholic when you were young, but I didn't pick up on that. So you've been going to Mass and you've been going to communion then, right?
Yes.
I see. Well, then in that case, there's no reason to wait at all. There's no purpose in waiting. You could be, if the priest is free, you could be conditionally baptized today if he was willing to do that.
Okay, because I'm contemplating, well, if I were to get married, if I were to, like I said before, receive holy orders, I don't want to have to be last minute looking for a baptismal record. I at the present time, I can't find, there is no baptismal record. I called the church mm-hmm. where I was baptized, and they don't have it.
I see. Yeah, I think you're smart to pursue conditional baptism. And the nice thing about it, given your circumstances, is there's no waiting period. If the priest is willing to do it, you can be baptized as soon as possible.
That's great. Thanks. Thanks once again.
You're welcome, Paul. God bless
day.
You. Yeah, you too. Exciting times on the Patrick Madrid Show. And Cyrus, that was exactly the song I was going to ask you to play. You read my mind. I'll be right back. Notre Dame Federal Credit Union is a member of the Catholic Credit Unions of America. You can find more information and your local Catholic Credit Union at relevantradio.com/banking.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
You may not have heard this yet, but if you signed up for our for the Father Rocky emails at relevantradio.com, you saw one this morning and maybe one yesterday about how the Pope has said January 26th as a day of prayer for peace in Ukraine, saying he's worried about Ukraine and a possible Russian-Ukrainian conflict and how that could spread. He proclaimed January 26th as a day of prayer for peace, saying, "I am following with concern the rising tensions that threaten to strike a new blow at peace in Ukraine and put into question the security of the European continent with even wider repercussions." He says, "I make a heartfelt appeal to all people of goodwill to pray to Almighty God that all political actions and initiatives will serve human fraternity rather than partisan interests." So do pray. Nancy and I spent some time watching some of the European news last night to kind of catch up on their take on this. And it's clear that something is going on. I mean, the Russians are, they're massing their army and the tanks and all this stuff that goes with that. In some cases, right on the border with Ukraine, in some cases, far away, you know, 100 miles away, but it's such a huge area that even 100 miles away is not that far. And so it's setting off all sorts of alarm bells, and NATO is stirring, and the United States, you probably heard yesterday, gearing up to send, putting on high alert right now, close to 9,000 U.S. Servicemen and women to be deployed in various places throughout Europe and maybe over there. So it's hard to say exactly what's happening, but I keep thinking about this, and I hope I'm wrong, but I keep thinking that if this is just a distraction, and it could be just a distraction, then maybe as everybody is focused on Ukraine and the possibility of a conflict there, that might be the opportunity for China to invade Taiwan. While everybody's looking on that side of the earth, then maybe China would say, well, now's our chance. I don't know. I wouldn't put it past some of these world leaders to try to do something like that. But in any case, the last thing we need is a war. And certainly we don't need a war with the Soviet, well, Russia, not the Soviet Union. We don't need a war with them because, as the Pope rightfully says, that could spin out of control. That could escalate and get out of control very quickly. So let's do pray for peace. And don't forget what Our Lady at Fatima, she said, pray for peace. And she talked specifically about Russia and its errors and nations being annihilated, etc. So that's not all in the past. I mean, there may be some present and future that pertains to those statements that she made in Fatima in 1917. So let's do pray. Also, a little bit of sad news here. Peter Robbins, I don't know if the name means anything to you. It didn't mean anything to me till I read the story, but he was the original voice of Charlie Brown. He was the actor who voiced Charlie Brown back in the 60s. So like 1965's A Charlie Brown Christmas. And then it's The Great Pumpkin Charlie Brown in 1966. He died at the age of 65. Relatives say that he committed suicide. He was 9 years old when he first started voicing Charlie Brown. He battled a lifelong mental illness. He struggled with addiction. He had run-ins with the law. In 2013, he pleaded guilty for a stalking charge. He wound up going to jail for a time. But in 2019, he was released from prison, and he seemed to be better off for it. In his own words, he said, "I would recommend to anybody who has bipolar disorder to take it seriously, because your life can turn around in the span of a month, like it did to me." He said, "I came out of prison and I'm a better person for it. I'm much more humble and grateful and thankful that I lived through the experience." So he has passed away. Cyrus, I think we have a sampling of his voice as Charlie Brown from back in the 60s.
Yeah, everybody knows this. Yeah.
"Actually, Lucy, my trouble is Christmas. I just don't understand it. Instead of feeling happy, I feel sort of let down."
"You need involvement. You need to get involved in some real Christmas project. How would you like to be the director of our Christmas play?"
"Me? You want me to be the director of the Christmas play?"
Yeah, that's a really, really sad story.
It is. And all the more so because he had a mental illness that just hampered him in his adult life. But I hope and pray that he died in the state of grace, please God. So, in your kindness, remember him, because all of us enjoyed Charlie Brown growing up. Kids today still enjoy that. Lastly, before we go to the phones, another bit of information for your Good to Know file. This is from the New York Post. The newly elected governor of Virginia, Glenn Youngkin, has set up a special tip line for parents in Virginia to report schools that are teaching their kids divisive critical race theory. It's part of a new Help Education initiative that he says will help enforce his first executive directive in office, which is to ban this controversial teaching method. And we've talked about critical race theory many times on the program. It started off as a legal lens through which legal cases were analyzed with one particular Harvard law professor back in the 60s. And it was primarily an academic issue until the last several years, when it began to break out into the mainstream with books like White Fragility and other books that propose that everything ultimately should be seen through the lens of race. And it is taught in the schools, not always by that name, but the tenets of critical race theory are indeed being taught. So this was part of the campaign message that he promoted. And Terry McAuliffe, the former governor of Virginia, who actually lost the election, I think largely due to one of his gaffes. This particular one is where he said that parents don't really have, I'm paraphrasing, parents really don't have a say in what their children learn in school. That's how what he said was interpreted. And that specifically had to do with critical race theory that many people are concerned about. So if you're interested in what this new Republican governor is doing in Virginia, whether you agree or not, I mean, a lot of people disagree with him. But he says Virginia schools will continue to teach all history, the good and the bad. So he says that there's not going to be any shying away from the terrible aspects of American history with regard to Jim Crow laws and slavery, etc. But what he's saying is parents have a right to know what their children are being taught, and also to have input as to what the children are taught in the curricula. And this is a very big deal in various parts of the country, certainly is in Virginia. And so he's enabling parents to be able to not only know what's going on, but also if their children come back and say, "Well, they're teaching us that all white people are racist by definition," then it can be looked into to see if it's something that is aberrant or not. So that article will be available, as with all the articles, on the show Twitter feed at P Madrid Show. Let's go to Bethany now in Alpena, Michigan. Hi, Bethany.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering what I have to do to get conditionally baptized, because I was baptized Lutheran, and now you've got me really worried about it.
Uh-oh.
So is it on the website what I have to do?
Well, no. So let me walk you through it. First of all, Lutheran baptisms, with rare, rare exceptions, are going to be presumed valid, because Lutherans have a history of valid baptisms. So as long as the Lutheran...
I shouldn't worry?
Well, let me walk you through it, okay? First of all, though, no, don't worry. Don't panic. I'm sure everything's fine. But okay. Why don't we just take a quick inventory here? How old were you when you were baptized?
Just an infant, like 7 months.
Okay. And you were baptized at, you know, the First Lutheran Church of Alpena, Michigan, or something like that, right? An established Lutheran
something
church.
Something like that.
Okay.
And my children were there, too, yes.
Okay. Oh, your children were there when you were baptized?
Yeah. My.
Oh, so you were baptized as an adult.
No, honey. I mean, I baptized my children at that church also.
No, I see. Okay. I thought you meant your children witnessed your baptism. Okay. So you were a little baby.
No.
Yep. And your parents were there. You probably had a godmother and godfather there with you.
That's a good question. I don't actually know who my godparents are. I don't know.
Well, almost certainly, and I would be very surprised if a Lutheran minister did not baptize in a valid way. So the validity depends upon three things. One is the valid form, which is that as the water is being poured, or you could be immersed, but more typically the water would be poured over your head. As the water is being poured, the minister would say the words out loud, "I baptize you in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit." That's all that needs to be said for it to be valid. So that's the first requirement. Second requirement is that it has to be water that is poured over your head. It can't be grape juice, can't be motor oil, can't be any other kind of liquid. It has to be actual water. And then the third requirement is that he has to intend to do what the church does. In other words, he has to intend to baptize you. And almost certainly right. He did. So I think that there's no reason to be concerned. And if you want to go to that Lutheran church or get in touch with them, they, like the Catholic Church, are very meticulous about preserving baptismal records. So they would almost certainly have the baptismal certificate telling you the date you were baptized, who baptized you, your parents, your godparents. They should have all that information on file.
I think I have that with the little cloth and everything. I think that's somewhere in the stuff that I got when my mother passed away.
Oh, okay.
But as for my children, though, I thought that he just did a cross on their forehead like the other man was saying.
Yeah, see, that would be considered a doubtful baptism. The water's supposed to flow. Okay, so now I can see where there might be some question, but if that's the case and you want to find out about conditional baptism, just simply make an appointment with your parish priest and let him know about the question, and then he can help you sort it out. And if he feels as though, you know what, maybe you should be conditionally baptized, he can take care of that for you and your children.
Okay, all right, so I'm going to call that church. Okay.
Yeah. Had it not been for that little wrinkle, I would say there's no reason to be concerned.
Okay. Okay. Well, thank you so much for the information.
You're welcome, Bethany. Thank you. Just as an aside, you may remember in the past year or so, there were two separate instances of Catholic priests. And the one I remember his story a little bit more clearly because he was a newly ordained Catholic priest, or had been ordained within the last year or so. And he happened to be watching a video cassette, a VHS tape of his own baptism. And the deacon who baptized him invalidly. And I'm trying to remember what the specifics were about the invalidity of it. I think it was that the deacon, as he poured the water, said something like, "I baptize you in the name of the Creator and the Redeemer and the Sanctifier," which is not a valid baptism. So in his horror, this newly ordained priest realized, among other things, that he was not a newly ordained priest, because in order for anyone to receive the sacraments validly and fruitfully, you have to have the sacrament of baptism. That's the foundation for all the other sacraments, without which you can't receive the sacrament. You might think you're receiving it, but you're not. So he took this to his bishop. Of course, the bishop recognized the problem, and so he had to get baptized validly. And then he repeated, I shouldn't say repeated, but then he validly received all of his other sacraments. So he was baptized, and then he was confirmed, and he received his first Holy Eucharist, and then he was ordained to the diaconate and then ordained to the priesthood, even though he had done all those things ostensibly by virtue of the fact that he had never been validly baptized, none of those other ostensible sacraments were valid either. So this is how serious the church takes this. And some people say, oh, that's just legalism. No, it's not. It's not legalism. I mean, the sacrament is either valid or invalid. Some people say, well, the church supplies, or, you know, God understands, and it's the sincerity of the person. And if the person wasn't validly baptized or validly absolved, the Lord understands, and he'll just treat it as if it were the case. No, that's not true. That's a nice idea. I mean, it's a comforting thought, but it's not true. It would be no more true than if you bought a house and you paid your money and you moved in only to find that there was some subterfuge and the person who sold you the house didn't actually own it in the first place. Somebody else owned it. And he didn't want to sell you the house, but this guy rigged the system somehow and he, quote unquote, sold you the house that you're now living in. But if they discover that you actually don't own the house because the person who really owned the house didn't want to sell it, and the charlatan is the guy who did it, well, you'd have to move out of the house because it doesn't rightfully belong to you. Now, I know that's a very, you know, kind of a far-fetched type of scenario, but it could happen. You know, you could be sincerely convinced that you won the lottery, only to find out that the liquor store where you bought the scratch-off or the lottery ticket had counterfeited it or something like that. And you may say, but I have the winning numbers. And they say, yeah, but that wasn't a valid ticket. It wasn't real. You didn't really win the $300 million. I'm sorry. So you could be sincere and jump up and down and stamp your foot, but it doesn't mean that you won the money if there was something invalidating about it. That's why, not to put too fine a point on it, but that's why the church is so serious about this. That's why baptismal records are kept. And that's why when you go to get married, the parish will ask you to produce your baptismal certificate, among other documents, so that you can demonstrate that you are prepared or you're apt to be able to receive the sacrament of holy matrimony. That's what these things are for. So no, it's not legalism. No, it's not just the rules of men. No, it's not just the church being finicky. No, it's none of those things. It's because these are really, really important issues. And one's eternal life can hang in the balance in some instances. So there you have it. All right. More to come right after this. You're listening to The Patrick Madrid Show. My number is 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. I will be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Keeping it relevant. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Join the conversation at 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149.
All right. This is mall walking music, Cyrus. You know what mall walking is?
I certainly do.
I've reached that age. I'm not ashamed to admit it.
I was going to say, when I was a kid, when I was a mall rat, we'd always see the mall walkers.
Yeah. They're people of a certain age. And, you know, in our case, when it's bitterly cold outside, and you can't walk outside, it's just too painful. So the mall, which is half closed up anyway, half the stores are empty, and there's nobody there. It's a wonder that some of these malls are still open. You know, yeah. I think they're going to start turning them into condominiums and they're going to convert them into living spaces for people, I do predict. And then you can pop some restaurants and things in there for the people who want to live there. But in any case, yeah, I mean, it's a very convenient thing when it's cold, 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 and you want to get a couple of miles in.
Yeah, you got to get your steps. That's good.
Yeah. I have no shame. No shame whatsoever.
And
I'm
you,
a
and
mall
you did it
walker.
With your wife, I'm guessing.
Oh, of course.
Right? Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. So if, you know, we were probably the youngest people there in terms of the mall walking crowd.
I'm a mall walker.
Hey, there you go. You could write a song. How about Nora in Cincinnati? Good morning, Nora, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. We have three children, and I'm 9 months pregnant with our fourth.
Congratulations.
Our family, thank you. Our family home is, you know, a relatively peaceful one in terms of you know, what peaceful and peacefulness can be.
Right.
But, you know, our oldest, she's 11 and a half. She's a straight A student, amazing girl at school, a wonderful friend to her friends. At home, it's a totally different story. Her psychologist even told me, like, she's definitely a difficult child. But it seems to be getting worse and worse every year. It's not getting any better, and I just feel it's an extreme aggressiveness towards me, in particular towards her brothers, her two brothers, and her father not so much, because she knows who she can get away with it.
Yeah.
If you can give me any guidance.
Yeah, I mean, I'll try. I'm not a counselor, and I don't have any training, you know, in that field, but I can offer you some thoughts for what they're worth. How old did you say your daughter was?
She's 11 and a half, the oldest.
And is this phenomenon just sort of starting in the last year or so, or has she been her whole life?
She's always been a difficult child since she was two. She's just been, you know, in a different way, but it's getting worse to the point that she will yell at me if I pick up her laundry to wash her laundry, things like that. It's just, you know, not normal.
Now, when you tell her, when you rebuke her for that and you say, no, you can't do that, what is her reaction? Does it just escalate?
Her action, in the moment, it will escalate. And I feel like if I need to stand up and rebuke her, as you say, it comes to this point of like a war of who has more power. Because that's but when we talk about it in front of the psychologist, she'll break down and say, "But you always say you make me feel that you're always angry with me." And so it's not the case. We try to give her as much love as her as possible, but obviously, when you know she's treating me like that or brothers, going to be a reaction.
Right, and it's unacceptable that she can act like that. So. Yeah. Part of it, this may be, when she says that, it could be her way of trying to manipulate things, because she knows that it's going to be hard for mom, you know, if it looks as though mom is the one who's always angry and she's just reacting to mom's anger, which is not what's going on, it sounds like. So maybe she's clever and she's figured out that she can turn
it. She's extremely smart.
Yeah. Okay, so since she's already going to a counselor, I guess that would have been part of my advice. But my question is that paying any dividends? Do you see any progress there?
Not for now. She's only been going like once a month over the, you know, on and off. Now we're starting to take her once a week because 2 weeks ago on her school computer, she looked up how to kill herself, which is, I'm saying it very calmly now, but this is, we did not take this lightly. We were informed by the school director. And she explained to me that she would never do it. She was just curious because she was so angry, but then she would never do that to us, and she would never do that. So that's why we're trying to take her once a week.
As I understand it, again, I'm not a counselor. I don't have training in that. But I understand that to be what's called ideation, where when somebody begins to have the idea of suicide, that's a big red flag. It's one of the early warning red flags that you're right to take very seriously. So my thought would be maybe number one, you need to get her into some more intensive counseling and therapy so that she can, you know, work through this issue and deal with and be helped in dealing with these ideations of suicide. So if she's looking it up, that is a major red flag, as you already know. You don't need me to tell you that. But I would consider getting her into some kind of more intensive and more frequent therapy to see how to get her through this period. The second thing would be in that clinical environment with the experts who can do these evaluations, maybe take her to a child psychologist who would be in a position to evaluate her medically as well as psychologically. And it may be that she could be helped by a medication that would help her to you know, maybe she's bipolar, or maybe there is some other clinical condition that if you catch it early enough, Maybe with some medication, mm-hmm. it could help smooth that out. But only they would be able to tell you that. I couldn't tell you that.
Yeah.
And then after that, after you take those steps, which I would take immediately if you haven't already done so, then I would say pick up a couple of books by Dr. James Dobson, who himself is a psychologist. So he has his medical degree and he's an expert in that field. He's also a prominent Protestant figure. But he's written a number of really good books. One is called The Strong-Willed Child. Another is called Dare to Discipline. And I think his first book, or at least the one that made the biggest splash, is Love Must Be Tough. And so these are different books on the same topic. They look at situations like yours. How do you deal with a willful child, a child who's abusive or angry or disruptive or what have you? And so in my view, his advice is sound. It's scripturally based. You know, it's Christian oriented, but it's also derived from his medical expertise and his psychological expertise. So mm-hmm. any or all of those books, I think, would be beneficial to help you, okay. you know, get some more strategies in place for how you'll deal with her.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Do you have the suicide prevention information? Can I give that to you if you have a pen handy?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Okay. So the 800 number, it's a national number, 800-273-8255. 800-273-8255, 24/7. They're always available for anybody who's contemplating suicide or in the case of you knowing that this is going on, they may be able to help you. Also, the website is suicidepreventionlifeline.org. Mm-hmm. Suicidepreventionlifeline.org. Mm-hmm. And there will be resources there for family members who are concerned.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're welcome. I hope and pray, Nora, that you call me back in a month or two and tell me that everything's much better. And I'll pray for that.
I hope so. Thank you so much again.
You're welcome. God bless you and your husband and your beautiful family. 888-914-9149. How about Joe now over in Oxnard, California? Hi, Joe.
Good morning, Patrick. I am coming up on my 2-year wedding anniversary. We had a beautiful wedding in a Catholic church, and mm-hmm. my priest announced and basically allowed anybody to come up for the Eucharist during communion. And okay. I never said anything, and it's really bothered me ever since, because I try to preach and teach people about my Catholic faith whenever I get the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And I've never really addressed it, and it's always kind of bothered me.
And you feel as though you need to address it with him because it's still bothering you?
It's bothering me, so I feel like I must need to do something, and I'm not sure what the right thing would. I mean, first, what are your thoughts as far as why the priest would even allow that?
I don't know what was going through his mind. I have known priests before, or known of priests before, who mistakenly think they're doing people a favor, or they mistakenly think that they're being pastoral, or they mistakenly think that they are being sensitive by telling non-Catholic folk, let's say at a Catholic wedding, everybody's welcome to come forward. That's not what the church teaches, never has been. I think it was yesterday that I spent some time looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 11, the second half of the chapter in which St. Paul warns about why under certain circumstances you should not receive communion if you're unworthy or you don't discern or recognize the body. I don't have to go back into all that. I'm sure you know that. And that is the standard teaching of the church on this issue. But why do some priests take it upon themselves to give bad pastoral advice like that? I would think it's because they think they're doing something nice, or they think they're doing something pastoral. But in fact, it's very destructive. It's destructive of the people who go forward to receive communion because they think it's okay, and they're actually piling on another sin in the case of sacrilege. So it's, let's just put a good face on it and assume that it was a misguided attempt to be nice. Whatever, I don't know, and only God knows, and that priest. So as for you, if this is torturing you, There's no reason for you to feel tortured if you're worried that maybe you had done something to cause that. I mean, I can't imagine how on earth you could blame yourself for something like that. You had no role in it.
Yeah, I guess. You're right. I mean, somehow I feel like, am I complicit? Because it was my wedding. I should have addressed it with the priest beforehand and said, please don't.
No.
You know, I honestly had no idea. But
no. Okay. You know why? Because that's not your job. Your job on your wedding day is to be the, you know, the handsome groom marrying your wife. You're there to receive your sacrament. His job is to attend to the sacramental and liturgical issues. That's not your job. So the fact that he didn't do his job properly does not in any way reflect negatively on you.
Okay. Well, thank you, Patrick. I appreciate the
You're welcome. The time. Yeah. Pray for him. Maybe pray a rosary for him. That may help you feel better. I'll be right back.